Well, we are, as you know, in the Genesis narratives from chapter 12 to 50. And again, that section of Genesis kicks off with God's call of Abraham to go from where he lives to the land of Canaan, and God will make him great and bless him, and he will become a blessing to all the families of the earth. And so now we are on to the second generation after Abraham. And this is part of the story of the generations of Isaac. So the story is primarily about Jacob. So our text for tonight is Genesis 31, verses 22 to 55, which is a ridiculously long passage. But we'll do our best to cover it and try to bring out the message that is there for us. And so my ESV Bible has this whole chapter, though, chapter 31, under the heading of Jacob Flees from Laban. So last week we covered the first 21 verses, I think, of that passage. And the thesis last week was we are to live with a deep awareness that God is with us. And what we have tonight is an expansion of that, essentially, into what that means that God is with us. So what we'll do tonight with this long passage is we'll read it, and as we read through it, I'll pause from time to time and comment on it, and then we'll go into the message. Usually that's one step we're going to save to go through tonight. So let's pick up the story in Genesis 31, and I'll actually read about three extra verses so that we can get the feel for where we are. I'll read it, Genesis 31, beginning in verse 19. So this is, as you remember, God has called Jacob now to leave his, the place where he is, and go to the land of Canaan, just like he did to Abraham a couple of generations earlier. And Laban has treated him badly. He has worked for him for 20 years, and so it's now time for him to go, and he's setting out to go, and we'll start in verse 19. And Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole her father's household gods. And Jacob tricked, or stole the heart of Laban the Aramean, by not telling him that he intended to flee. He fled with all that he had, and arose and crossed the Euphrates, and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. So if you noticed, when I read verse 20, I read it as it is in the ESV, and Jacob tricked Laban the Aramean. If you would translate that really woodenly literally, it would say, and Jacob stole the heart of Laban the Aramean. And it doesn't mean what we think of when we think of stealing someone's heart, like when I said to my wife, "You stole my heart." It doesn't mean that. Doesn't mean that at all. It more has the idea of that he tricked him or deceived him, or actually even the idea that he made him do things that he wouldn't normally do. He kind of half drives him crazy, by what his actions are. So it can mean anything in that range. So I'll pick it up. And the reason I brought that out is because this word stole is a big part of this passage. And so to get the feel for it, there's a couple other times when I'll do that as well, when a different word is used by the ESV. So verse 22, when it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him for 7 days and followed close after him, or clung to him, in the hill country of Gilead, which is where Laban was setting out to go to get to this place so that he could get to Canaan. So this is about 300 miles on his 500-mile trip. He's trying to get there. But God came to Laban, the Aramean, in a dream by night, and he said to him, "Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad." Now, verse 25, and Laban overtook Jacob, so he caught up to him. And Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban with his kinsmen pitched their tents in the hill country of Gilead. Something to note here, pitched his tent. There, you can say that different ways. This has the way that this is reads is you could hear essentially the hammers pounding the tent pegs into the ground. It's the same kind of a word that is used to sound a trumpet, and it has the idea that they are going to be hostile toward each other. And Laban said to Jacob, so Laban approaches Jacob, and he says, "What have you done that you have stolen my heart and driven away my daughters like captives of the sword?" So if you remember from last time, the daughters were really happy to go with Jacob. It isn't like this at all. Laban completely misreads the way his daughters think. They are happy to go with Jacob because they think that their father has treated them badly. And so they're happy to go. And Laban is trying to get their support, that you've driven away my daughters like captives of the sword. But that's not the case. Laban is mistaken there. "And why did you flee secretly and steal me and not tell me, so that I might have sent you away with mirth and songs and tambourine and lyre? And why did you not permit me to kiss my sons and my daughters farewell? Now you have done foolishly." Again, what he's trying to do is gain the support of his family, his daughters, and grandchildren, and really most likely just feigning, pretending that this is what he would have liked to have happened. More than likely, what Laban was really after was what happened 6 years before, when Jacob said, "Let me go now, go back to my country," and Laban essentially talks him into staying. So Laban, if he would have told him back then, Laban again would have tried to talk him into staying, almost certainly, because God blesses Laban because of Jacob. Now, his kids, though, on the other hand, certainly are against Jacob, and Laban was turning that way, but he did know, so to speak, on which side his bread was buttered. And he knew that Jacob was good for him in that way. So he said, "Now you have done foolishly." And then in verse 29, "But is in my power to do you harm?" I'm going to come back to that later, but look at that verse real quickly. "It is in my power to do you harm." So Laban says to Jacob, "Yes, I have been warned." He's already been warned, and he says, "It's in my power to do you harm, but the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, 'Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad.'" So he relays that to Jacob, what God has already said to him, but still maintains, "It is my power, and the only in my power to do you harm, and the only reason I'm not is because I'm deferring to your God, the God of your father," essentially. And then he adds in verse 30, "And now you have gone away because you longed greatly for your father's house." So he knew that he wanted to go back home. But then he says, "Why did you steal my gods?" So remember at the at the beginning of this. Rachel is the one who stole the household gods of Laban. And Jacob answered and said to Laban, "Because I was afraid, for I thought that you would take your daughters from me by force." So Jacob says the opposite. Laban says, "You carried them away by force," essentially. And Jacob says, "Well, I think you were going to keep them by force. You weren't going to let me leave with my wives, your daughters." And then he adds this, a really foolish thing to say. "Anyone with whom you find your gods shall not live. In the presence of our kinsmen, I point out what I have, or point out what I have that is yours, and take it." So Jacob now appeals to those who have come with Laban, who would be his relatives as well, because remember, this is one big family. Jacob is the son-in-law of Laban. He is also the son of Laban's sister. And so they're all related. And Jacob then appeals to the group now and says, "Show me what I've done wrong," essentially. "Point it out if I've stolen anything from you, because I want you to show it to the kinsmen and let them judge, and then take whatever's yours." And Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them, so he didn't know. So verse 33 then. "So Laban went into Jacob's tent, and into Leah's tent, and into the tent of the two female servants, but he did not find them." So he didn't find the gods. "And then he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's. Now Rachel had taken the household gods and put them in the camel's saddle and sat on them." So let's talk about that for just a minute. So there are no known pictures of what this would have looked like at this time, which would have been almost 2000 B.C., more like 1700 probably B.C. or so. But a newer picture, a few hundred years later, a drawing shows what a camel's saddle looked like with a place to carry things. And it was essentially a box that sat on top of the camel that may have been like this tall. Okay. And then there was a place to sit on top of that. So it would have been obvious that there's some kind of a, it's not like they were hidden away in some secret place, most likely. There's a storage compartment there for whatever you're carrying on your camel. So it's probably there, and that's probably right where these household gods were, which brings to the question, okay, what are household gods? It's not certain exactly what these would have looked like, but I've been to the Israel Museum, and they have some examples of what things, people, little figurines that people made, and probably would have been something like this. You know, they range in size from like army man size to a little bit bigger. Sometimes they look like people. Often they look like cattle or oxen, really, really common, and in various sizes. So this word is called teraphim, and it's built on, it could be built on a number of different roots, but one of those possibilities is that it's built on the root for heel, so that these are things that would be healing for you. They're things that you might think would be able to heal you. Almost certainly, they know for sure that there was ancestor worship in that time, and they may have represented ancestor worship as well. But nobody actually thought that these were actual gods. They represented other gods or represented deceased ancestors. And so as Laban asked for these things, they could have been very, very small. Later on, this same kind of thing is used when David is escaping from Saul and his wife hides one of these things in the bed. So there's obviously a variety of sizes because they mistake it for David. So this is the idea here, though, that some kind of a symbol that represents a god, and that is what we're looking for, or what Laban was looking for with Rachel. So verse 35... I didn't finish that verse. Now we'll go back to 34. Now Rachel had taken the household gods and put them in the camel's saddle and sat on them. And Laban felt or groped all about the tent, but he did not find them. And she said to her father, "Let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you. For the way of women is upon me." So he searched, but did not find the household gods. So he doesn't make her get up. He doesn't want to look in the little box that's there on the camel because of her situation. And so he just gives up and says, I guess I didn't find him. And then Jacob became angry and berated Laban. And Jacob said to Laban, "What is my offense? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? For you have felt through all my goods. What have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen that they may decide between us two." So again, Jacob is he's appealing to what he's already said in saying, okay, you've had your chance now to search this thing. If I've stolen anything, it should be evident. Let's put it before our kinsmen. Let's let them see that. So it's obvious to them that Laban is unable to find anything that Jacob had stolen, and so this was obvious to his kinsmen, and they would surely pronounce that Jacob did not steal these. "These 20 years I have been with you, your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried, and I have not eaten the rams of your flocks. What was torn by wild beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. From my hand you required it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was, by day the heat consumed me, and the cold by night, and my sleep fled from my eyes. These 20 years I have been in your house. I have served you 14 years for your daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you have changed my wages 10 times." So now he lays out his whole case. He feels pretty vindicated about the household gods. He feels brave. I think he thinks that the kinsmen now are on his side. So he feels comfortable laying out his case between happy to do that with Laban, his father-in-law. And then he says this, "And if the God of my father, the God of Abraham, in the fear of Isaac, had not been on my side, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God saw my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night." So we're going to come back to that. And that, the theme for tonight is taken from this verse in verse 42. So just mark that. "Then Laban answered and said to Jacob, 'The daughters are my daughters. The children are my children. The flocks are my flocks. All that you see is mine.'" He's starting to sound somewhat like a madman, right? But what can I do this day for these, or to these, my daughters, or for their children, or to their children, in whom they have borne? Come now, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me. So this kind of a covenant between people in a situation like this, the normal thing to happen would be that the inferior party would petition for a covenant. Laban has controlled this relationship for 20 years, and you can see by his ranting that something is not working well for him. And if he's just the fact that he's the one that asks for the covenant, means that he's at least viewing Jacob now as his equal. He has no case against him, though he would love to have found the household gods and made him indebted to him. He hasn't, and now he comes to him asking for a covenant. So Jacob took a stone, this is verse 45, and set it up as a pillar. And Jacob said to his kinsmen, gather stones. And they took stones and made a heap, or a pile, and they ate there by the heap. And Laban called it, don't worry about the pronunciation, it means something like a witness heap in Aramaic. But Jacob called it Galeed, which would mean a witness heap in Hebrew. So they're just using different languages there. It doesn't mean that they're calling it different things. They're saying this is a pile of stones that is going to bear witness. And Laban said, this heap is a witness between you and me today. Therefore, he named it Galeed. That would have been what Jacob named it. And Mizpah, for he said, the Lord watch between you and me. This is still Laban speaking. The Lord watch between you and me when we are out of one another's sight. If you oppress my daughters, or if you take wives besides my daughters, although no one is with us, see, God is a witness between you and me. So years and years ago, many, many years ago, as I think about it, when I was in high school, they used to have these little pendants. They were called Mizpah, right? And there was like a crooked line that went between them. They matched up so they'd be together, and like a boy would give them to his girlfriend, or a girl would give them to her boyfriend, and it said, may the Lord watch between you and me. Thinking, well, that's a good thing. Well, not if you go by this. This is a may the Lord watch between you and me in case you violate our agreement and come after you. So if you oppress my daughters, if you take wives besides my daughters, though no one is with us, see, God is witness between you and me. Then Laban said to Jacob, see this heap and pillar which I have set between you and me, this heap is a witness, and the pillar is a witness that I will not pass over this heap to you, and you will not pass over this heap and this pillar to me to do harm. The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us. So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Notice that it's, again, Laban that's asking for the terms, essentially, saying, I'm willing to not come across this line to do you harm, but you have to be willing to not come across this line to do me harm. And so he's asking for the terms. I am going to come back also to this, to verse 53, and we'll talk about that in a little while. And Jacob offered a sacrifice in the hill country and called his kinsmen to eat bread. They ate bread and spent the night in the hill country. Early in the morning, Laban arose and kissed his grandchildren and his daughters and blessed them. And then Laban departed and returned home And so he goes back. He goes back to his home, and they part ways, and we never hear from him again. I mentioned that verse 42, if you want to look at verse 42, that this is what we're going to come back to and make our thesis on tonight. And I just want to qualify it, and this thesis only applies if you are among the people of God. So if we are part of the people of God like Jacob was, if we have faith in Jesus Christ and are part of his people, then from this verse, the one true God is on your side. So if the God, here's the verse, if the God of my father, the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac had not been on my side, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God saw my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night. So God was on his side. Jacob knew that God was on his side, and he knew what it meant that God was on his side. So does anybody, that's the ESV. Does anybody have, I know that the NIV says something different, and the New American Standard also says something different. Does anybody have the NIV? Where it says, had not been on my side. Had not been with me. That's the NIV, right? Yep. How about New American Standard? Anybody have that? Yeah. If God had not been for me. If God had not been for me. Which is exactly the reference that Pastor Randy made this morning, talking about what it means when God is with you if you're among his people. That God is for you. It's a different thing. If you're part of his people, God is for you. And that would be the most natural way to translate that. That God is for me. So if God had not been for me or on my side, surely you would have sent me away empty-handed. So the first point under the one true God is on your side is this. There is only one true God. Now, that's probably not a big surprise to you that we would say that, right? So, in fact, if I asked each person here tonight, do you think that there is only one true God? I would expect everybody to answer yes, and then some of you to add, I know it's true. And others to add, okay, I know it's true, so let's move on before I fall asleep. So why is it one of the points here tonight? Why is it one of the points? Well, because in this text, it's clearly taught. That's one of the things that is clearly taught here in this text, is there is one God and only one true God. We've already talked about the household gods, and we're going to talk about something beside that. So who is the one true God? I mean, we might answer something like, he's the creator. He is the sovereign king. He's the king of kings. He's the ruler of the world. He knows everything. He's all-powerful. He's everywhere. We might answer those kind of questions. But look how Jacob answers it. Look how he would answer it based on this verse 42. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac, we'll come back to that too. The God of my father, a personal God, somebody that was with him personally, not something that is all true, but not kind of a picture of the creator, the sovereign ruler, the guy that's my God, the God that is my God, the God of my father. So let's look at Genesis 15 real quickly, first seven verses, to see what it means, what he means when he says, the God of my father, the God of Abraham. Verse 15. So this is after Abraham has rescued Lot from the king Chedorlaomer and other kings who came to attack that area. And after these things, this is 15 verse 1, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram, I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great. So he's a shield and he's going to have a great reward. But Abram said, O Lord God, what will you give me, for I continue childless, and the heir of my house is Eleazar of Damascus. And Abram said, behold, you have given me no offspring, and a member of my household will be my heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, this man shall not be your heir, your very own son shall be your heir. And he brought him outside and said, look toward the heaven and number the stars, if you are able to number them. Then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. And he believed the Lord, and he counted it to him as righteousness. And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out from Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess, the same place that Jacob was going back to. I am the God of Abraham. But did you notice how personal that was between God and Abram? So there are other places we could look at, but I just want to point out this idea of personal. So you are familiar with the term El Shaddai, right? So it's clear that, again, I bring this up once in a while, that the scholars really don't know what this means for sure. But the way that it's translated, so in the Greek Old Testament, so the one that Jesus would have been around during the times of Jesus, here's what it said. When it says, when God speaks to Abraham later, and to Jacob later, and says, I am El Shaddai, the Greek translates it this way, I am your God. I am your God. So if God had not been, if the God of Abraham had not been with me, you surely would have sent me away empty-handed. God is my God, and he is on his side. So, then there's this other statement in here. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been with me, you would have done this. Okay, so the fear of Isaac, only used a couple of times, both in this section. It's not the normal word for fear of God. Okay, so the fear of God, it's a different word. It means something like dread. So the dreaded one of Isaac. So what does that mean? Well, if you won't find it anywhere else like this, other than in this passage, but you will find that word other places. You will find the dread other places. So one of those places is in Exodus 15. So let's turn to Exodus 15, because I think this will help us clarify what it means to be the dreaded one of Isaac. Exodus 15, verses 14 to 16. So this is in what's called the Song of Moses, after the crossing of the Red Sea. This is chapter 15, verses 14, 15, and 16. The peoples have heard, they tremble. Pangs have seized the inhabitants of Philistia. Now are the chiefs of Edom dismayed. Trembling seizes the leaders of Moab. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. So notice this is about after the Red Sea happens, and the Egyptians are wiped out. Moses is singing about what the other nations are that have found out about this are doing. And then verse 16, terror and dread will fall upon them because of the greatness of your arm. They are still as a stone till your people, O Lord, pass by, till the people pass by whom you have purchased. So the dread comes to those who are outside. Right? The dread, in this case, comes to those who are not part of Israel. The dreaded one is Yahweh here, but he's dreaded to the people who are outside. Okay? It's used again in another sense, and I'll just, without turning to it, I'll tell you where it is. It's in Deuteronomy, where it does apply to the people of Israel. Okay, so dread's going to fall on you in this case if you abandoned your covenant with me, if you rebel against me and sin against me, I'm going to send you to other countries, and you will go into exile, and you will dread. So in rebellion to Yahweh or against Yahweh like these other nations are, he is to be dreaded. So the dreaded one is the God of Isaac. It doesn't mean that Isaac dreads him. It means he is the dreaded one. Clearly stands in the place of the word for God. A parallel to the God of Abraham is the dreaded one of Isaac. So, at the time of Jacob, it was not a settled matter that there is one true God, although we might think it's settled now. So, the teraphim, the household gods, right? There were a bunch of those, but the interesting thing about them is that they can be stolen. Right? So it doesn't really help if they're on your side, if they can be stolen. You can also hide them. They can't be found when you're looking for them. There is one true God. You can sit on them. You can bleed on them. They can be completely defiled. But also, it wasn't a settled matter, not only with Laban. Let's look at Joshua 24. So this is Joshua, right, as he is looking back. And it's got one of our favorite verses, I should say one of our favorite parts of a verse that we don't really read in context in this passage. But Joshua 24, verses 13 to 15. So this will tell us about gods. So 24, 13 to 15, I gave you a land, this is God speaking now, through Joshua, I gave you a land on which you had not labored, and cities that you had not built, and you dwell in them. You eat the fruit of the vineyards and the olive orchards that you did not plant. Now, therefore, fear the Lord, fear Yahweh, and serve him in sincerity and in faithfulness. Put away the gods that your fathers served beyond the river, so beyond the Euphrates, and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. And if it is evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, choose this day whom you will serve. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And if it is evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, then choose this day, choose this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your fathers served in the region beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, they will serve the Lord. So I said that part a little early. But they served. So these Israelites' ancestors served other gods and worshiped other gods. So Abraham's father, worshipped other gods. Abraham's brother worshipped other gods. And Laban is part of that family. He is part of that family where they served other gods. So, God is on your side. And there is only one true God. And we might think that matter is settled today. But as I heard this morning, not really. Because there are other kinds of gods. I think Pastor Randy this morning mentioned money, NFL football, and sexuality. Right? So we'll put God forth there. So in our time, they may not look exactly the same, the things that we worship, that there is one true God, but we worship other things. So there's another kind of God in addition to those things that we worship here today. Not here, I mean in our country, in our culture, that we worship, and that is the invented God. The one that we want to create in our own image. The one that says this: oh, God is love, and he would never condemn anyone. That's the God we worship in our culture, or one of the gods we worship in our culture. He would never condemn anyone for their religion as long as they're sincere. He will certainly have mercy on them. And what about the people that have never heard? He'd surely have mercy on them. And regarding sexuality, I mean, God made me this way, and he doesn't make junk, and so, you know, where's the love? I mean, God certainly wouldn't condemn me for that. So we in our culture worship a different God. Right? It's one that we invented. It's the one that everybody gets to go see, regardless of whether they have faith in Christ or not, when they die. It's that one. That's who our culture worships. And if we say that we don't worship that God, if we say we worship the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, we will be ostracized for that. So we haven't really settled in this country, in this whole Western culture, that there is one true God who has actually spoken to us. There's one true God who says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And no one comes to the Father but by me. But that is not the American God. That one true God is the only one that's able to protect you. We've already seen what happens with Laban's gods. They are pretty much worthless, right? They are completely powerless, as were the gods of Egypt. When God spoke, and as will be the invented God in the end day. So in our verse today, the main verse that we're looking at for our thesis, if the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been on my side, surely you would have sent me away empty-handed. God saw my affliction and the labor of my hands, and rebuked you last night. So you can see what happened there. God protected, Jacob says it, he protected me from you sending me away empty-handed, though you would have cheated me out of everything that you had, out of everything that I had. And not only that, but you would have laid your hands on me and either killed me or harmed me or forced me to go back to you. But God actually warns our people who would harm us in a dream, in this case, in other ways as well. I mean, so what kept Laban from looking the only place that he hadn't looked for his household gods. God did. Now, why would he do that? That's for another time. Why would he allow Rachel to keep these household gods? That's not the question here. The question is, what does God do to protect Jacob? He lets this happen. And he makes it so that Laban cannot discover this. So have you ever thought about this one, though? So what if the one true God were not on your side? Because that's what Jacob says. If God were not on my side, here's what would have happened to me. So if God were not on your side, what would have happened? So, well, we can see from Jacob that he would have fallen into Laban's hands. And that's a really, really bad thing, right? To fall in the hands of people. In fact, David chooses to get a plague sent on him, a pestilence sent on his people, rather than be pursued by people. Don't let me be pursued by people. I will put my hope in your mercy. So it would be a mess if God were not on our side. We'd have to pay the penalty for those rash statements that we made, like Jacob did. You know, whoever you find the gods with will die. You know, I've probably made some pretty stupid statements in my life. Right? I would have had to have lived with that. But most importantly, we would be without God and without hope in this world. Completely without God and without hope in this world. But that's not who we are. Right? By the blood of Jesus Christ, God is on our side. There's only one true God, and he's the only one that is able to protect us. And you don't want to dwell on it, but it's good to at least consider, like Jacob had obviously done. What if that hadn't happened? Right? How has God fulfilled his promises to me and kept me safe? So let's close in prayer, and then we'll have our final hymn.